Life sustains itself by cell division. So does cancer. Breast cancer cells multiply faster because of CDK4/6 proteins. But what if we could block those proteins and stop runaway cell division? To that end, Dana-Farber scientists laid the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, new drugs that are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. Dana-Farber's momentum of discovery keeps finding new ways to outmaneuver cancer. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
A presidential election in France
with global implications.
From APM, American Public Media, I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles.
And I'm David Brancaccio in New York. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It is Friday, April the 20th.
Coming up, the market goes up, the market goes down, but really, the market isn't going anywhere.
A conversation with the Secretary of Agriculture.
And Fenway Park's legacy in the world of real estate.
Those stories and more coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
This Marketplace podcast is brought to you by Gazelle.com. Gazelle buys the used iPhones, iPads, Macs, smartphones, and other gadgets from your home or office, so you can upgrade to the latest versions of your favorite gadgets. Find out what your gadget is worth at Gazelle.com. Don't just sell it, Gazelle it.
On Sunday, France will hold the first round of its presidential elections. Polls indicate the incumbent conservative Nicolas Sarkozy is in a close race with the socialist candidate François Hollande, and there are concerns that if Sarkozy loses the election, the economic ripples could spread across Europe and around the world. Marketplace's Stephen Beard joins us now from our European desk in London with more. Good morning.
Hello, Jeremy.
Well, we've had leadership changes in Greece and in Italy during the debt crisis, and they didn't seem to have a huge effect on global markets. Why is France a different story?
Well, this is potentially more destabilizing because remember, in the case of Italy and Greece, there wasn't an election and technocrats just took over. And crucially, they were ready to do what the Germans and the European Commission and the European Central Bank wanted. Now, in the case of France, there's an election and the front runner is a socialist politician who's been very critical of the austerity drive, the budget cutting pushed by the Germans. He says growth must come first. So if he wins, he could open up a bit of a rift between these two key, the most important countries in the Eurozone, France and Germany.
But if you look at the market reaction so far in the stock markets, in the bond markets, it doesn't appear like the global markets are too concerned about any potential ramifications of this.
Well, stay tuned. I mean, we've had these long periods of calm before. We suddenly erupt in financial frenzy. But some analysts say, yes, the markets are right to be relaxed because François Hollande can say one thing on the campaign trail. Whether he can deliver it in office is a different matter. Dominique Moisy of the French Institute for International Relations says when it comes to the Eurozone, a French president has to toe the line.
When it comes to economic, financial, monetary matters, there is a junior partner, that is France, and there is a senior partner, that is Germany.
So, Stephen, any idea who's going to win this election in France?
Dominique Moisy says it'll be a miracle if Sarkozy is reelected.
That's Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London.
The Republican-controlled House of Representatives has passed a $46 billion tax cut for most of America's employers that supporters knew had little hope of making it into law. Republicans had said it would help small businesses. Democrats said it was a new perk for wealthy taxpayers, and the president has threatened a veto. In this election year, there's much important work that's floating in limbo, including the massive 2012 Farm Bill. Joining us is the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack. Thanks for joining us, Mr. Secretary.
It's great to be with you, David.
The Farm Bill looks to be stalled in Congress, possibly for quite a long time. What does that mean, do you think, for U.S. agriculture?
Well, David, I'm not willing to concede that the Farm Bill is necessarily stalled. Obviously, we need a Farm Bill. There are many reasons for that. The safety net that it provides producers, the environmental and conservation practices that it pays for, and the rural development job creation that goes with it. And so we're obviously interested in getting a farm bill done this year.
Now, of course, the vast U.S. agriculture industry, really, farms, can tick along with that bill stalled, right? It's not going to be Armageddon if you don't get that passed.
Well, it depends. If you happen to be a farmer who finds yourself in the way of a tornado or a flood, you're going to need what I like to refer to as the Food, Farm, and Jobs Bill, because that's going to be the vehicle by which you will be able to continue to purchase crop insurance and continue to have some kind of a disaster program that overlays crop insurance to make sure that you're not put under by one disaster. Secondly, these farm programs also help to support our export efforts. We had a record year in ag exports last year, which has helped us to get to a record farm income. We need the programs within the Farm Bill to be able to continue to market ag products abroad.
Now, Mr. Secretary, you are still a fire-breathing defender of the use of biofuels. You don't worry that acreage used for fuel is acreage not used for food and food prices go up?
Well, the reality is that those are myths that have been propagated by those who are opposed to the biofuel industry. Let's, first of all, look at the benefits of that industry. Not only does it improve farm income, people need to know that gas prices would be somewhere between 80 cents and $1.30 a gallon more were it not for a biofuel industry. We are moving away from a reliance on corn, so we're now working to promote biorefineries that will use woody biomass, municipal waste, switchgrass, a whole series of alternatives that's going to add value, provide an opportunity for all regions of the country to participate in this industry and make it a little bit more convenient and more available for consumers.
And bless you for not saying the word cellulosic. Would you say woody?
Woody biomass.
All right. Well, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack, thank you very much for the time.
All right, David. Take care.
We got quarterly earnings from two big companies today. McDonald's said its profits were up 7% last quarter thanks to a 9% rise in U.S. restaurant sales and a 5% boost in Europe. Also, General Electric reported an 11% drop in profit during the first 3 months of the year. Part of that was a loss the company incurred from Irish mortgages. Let's get reaction from Chris Lowe, chief economist with FTN Financial. He's with us, as always, from New York. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, other than the fact that GE was apparently involved in Irish mortgages, any other surprises in these numbers this morning?
Ouch. Actually, both of them were beats. McDonald's did quite a bit better than expected. GE did just a little bit better than expected, which tells you at least, if nothing else, investors are paying attention.
Investors are paying attention, but if you look back at the stock market now, the last 2 months or so, we've been hovering right around 13,000 for the Dow. Why are we just stalled in this position?
Well, that's right. And I think, in fact, these two earnings reports are sort of emblematic of what's going on. The three biggest economies in the world are slowing down. That's the United States, Europe, and China. No one's really sure quite how much they will slow. But, you know, McDonald's is picking up business in places like Europe, of all things, because it's a cheap place to eat.
Right.
And as for GE, their earnings are down because industrial output is down as well. So what I see in these numbers is global slowdown. Not horrible, but Things are definitely cooler than they were.
And Chris, you mentioned Europe. I just want to ask you quickly. There's this election coming up in France this weekend that some people say could have an impact on the global economy.
Well, that's right. In France, it looks like the socialist candidate is going to win, and that means that austerity, which was the way Europe has been tackling its problems, is less likely to be popular going forward. It's one more uncertainty. We're not quite sure what they're going to replace it with, but I guess we'll find out in the next couple of months.
Chris Lowe, chief economist with FTN Financial, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, you just heard the news from Wall Street, but Marketplace Economics correspondent Chris Farrell says forget all that noise. What we really need to focus on is what's going on in America's middleweight cities. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
Well, Chris, when you talk about middleweight cities, what are you talking about?
All right. So these are the 255, 260 cities that have been identified by McKinsey and Company and has come out with this report about urban America, U.S. cities in the global economy. And what's fascinating, Jeremy, is that we know where you live, L.A., megacity, right?
Yep.
Very, very important. And where you used to live, New York. Okay, very
another
important.
Megacity.
I mean, right, and New Yorkers and people in L.A., they do think that they're the center of the universe. However, when you look at the dynamism in the U.S. economy, It's really these middleweight cities, places like where I live in the Twin Cities here in Minnesota, or Portland, Oregon, being another classic example. Almost 85% of U.S. GDP is generated by these middleweight cities, compared to about 65% in Europe.
Well, what is so different about these middleweight cities than the big cities?
Partly what these middleweight cities have is a certain dynamism. And, you know, a classic example in my mind is Pittsburgh. I mean, if you think smokestack America, industrial America, I mean, Pittsburgh was the epitome of that and then went to a long-term decline. But today, Pittsburgh is thriving, but it's thriving as an education center, as a healthcare center. It's reinvented itself. So these cities have the ability to reinvent themselves, and that's very dynamic. And remember, our economy is dynamic.
Okay, so they're dynamic places, but you're saying that on the list of our economic concerns that we should have middleweight cities right up at the top?
You know, we talk a lot about the competitiveness of the U.S. economy with the rise of China. Well, here's the thing, Jeremy. We talk about companies. We talk about individuals. Do they have skills? But what we should really be talking about is how healthy are our cities and what can help those cities, because then we'll be really competitive.
Marketplace economics correspondent Chris Farrell, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This Marketplace podcast is brought to you by Gazelle.com. Gazelle buys the used gadgets from your home or office, such as iPhones, iPads, iPods, Macs, or smartphones, so you can upgrade to the latest versions. At Gazelle.com, see what your used gadget is worth. Then mail it to Gazelle for free. Gazelle pays for the shipping, and you'll get paid fast. Gazelle helps you upgrade to the latest gadgets faster and gives you value for the used gadgets you replace. Find out what your used gadgets are worth at Gazelle.com. Don't just sell it, Gazelle it.
Formula One is the most popular kind of car racing in the world, with 500 million TV viewers worldwide. In the Middle East, organizers of the big F1 Grand Prix of Bahrain are pressing ahead despite demonstrations against the Bahrain regime's human rights record. The BBC's Simon Atkinson joins us from nearby Dubai to discuss the controversy. Good morning, Simon.
Good morning, David.
How tense is the situation on the ground, given the level of protest that we've seen?
Well, the situation is pretty tense, and it's impacting directly on the sport of Formula One already. There was an incident late on Wednesday night, I believe, when some petrol bombs were thrown in clashes between police and protesters, and one of those landed near the car containing members of one of the teams, a team called Force India. And this has kind of really hit home that these incidents aren't completely isolated from those taking part in the sport. And in fact, two members of that team have decided to leave the country on the basis that they don't feel safe. And in fact, one of the drivers from that team, Nico Hülkenberg, has said that, you know, we shouldn't have been put in this position to be here. So the tension on the ground has followed through into the sport.
And in fact, it's affecting this giant business that is Formula One racing.
It is. I mean, it's affecting them on two levels, really. I mean, it's affecting them on a reputational level, because Bahrain has really been brought into the spotlight because Formula One has decided to go ahead with the event. And it's brought attention onto things going on in the country, and they see that as an endorsement of a government which the protesters say is discriminatory, is not pushing through reforms, and is still arresting and torturing opponents. And then there's the economic side of things. I mean, just last year alone, Bahrain's economy lost about $500 million by the event not going ahead. So, you know, for Bahrain, there's a real financial impact. But then for the sport as a whole, there's been calls for sponsors to pull out because it's seen as inappropriate for it to be in Bahrain. And I guess time will tell and how things pan out on what the long-term business impacts are.
The BBC's Simon Atkinson, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much, David.
There are new details today in a major political scandal in China, the case of Bo Xilai, the once powerful Chinese official who was fired from the government as part of a murder investigation. Now, a Chinese journalist has told the BBC that an official cover-up of the murder began immediately after it happened. The BBC's Juliana Liu joins us from Hong Kong with more on this. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, take us back to the basics here. Just give us the sort of quick version of what this scandal is all about.
Well, we haven't seen a political scandal this magnitude really in decades in China. One of the country's most powerful men, tipped for a very senior position in the new government, has been fired from all his party posts because it has emerged that his wife is the prime suspect in the murder of a British businessman, Neil Hayward, who died last year. The government isn't being entirely forthcoming with the ongoing investigation. So you can imagine there are a lot of rumors about what's going on. And because he is such a popular figure, there are some people who even believe that there was no murder and that this entire scandal has been cooked up by the Beijing government.
And we certainly love our political scandals over here in this country. But what's at stake in China with this scandal? Why does it really matter?
Well, this man is the son of one of the founding fathers of China, essentially, and he's incredibly powerful. He was the party secretary of Chongqing, which is a city of 30 million people.
Wow.
He revitalized the city of Dalian, based on Washington, D.C., because he loved the layout of Washington, D.C., and he remade a city similar to that. So this is a man that the people have been following for decades. So there's a lot of interest in what will happen to him. And, of course, how this scandal is handled will tell people a lot about the way the Chinese government works.
The BBC's Juliana Liu in Hong Kong. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
A fascinating study from the Pew Research Center shows that about two-thirds of women age 18 to 34 in the U.S. put a high-paying career among their top life goals. And that is up sharply over the last 15 years. Young men are ambitious, but not at the same rate as women. Experts suggest some of this stems from so many women having the prime earning responsibility in so many families these days. Many Olympic athletes have to turn to corporate sponsorship to pay bills. But in the world of track and field, competitors are often not allowed to individually display logos or ads. Elizabeth Wynne Johnson has more on an elite runner who wants to change that.
Top-ranked in the 800 meters, Nick Simmons is a favorite for the U.S. Olympic track and field team. And he's become an outspoken critic of sponsorship rules in his sport. So to make a point, Simmons went on eBay and offered to tattoo his left shoulder with the logo of the highest bidder.
Specifically, what I'm talking about is the athletes' abilities to market themselves to companies.
A marketing firm in Milwaukee called Hanson Dodge Creative bid over $11,000. The sport took notice. USA Track and Field spokeswoman Jill Greer.
Nick brought to the general public's attention the overall issue of logo restrictions and usage for athletes.
But
what he did in terms of his eBay auction was to very much oversimplify the issue.
The Adidas and Nikes of the world put a lot of money directly into athletes' pockets by sponsoring meets.
So the fact that there were certain restrictions in place to protect manufacturer logos is simply a recognition of the economic nature of our sport.
As for Nick Simmons, the organizers of his next event have changed their rules, so he'll get to unveil his Hanson Dodge tattoo on Saturday. I'm Elizabeth Wynne Johnson for Marketplace.
1 week to the day after I finally dumped our collection of vinyl records, there's news that 4/21 tomorrow is Record Store Day. It's a celebration and a marketing opportunity for independent record stores across the country and around the world. It's the brainchild of Chris Brown. He's the man behind Bull Moose Records in Portland, Maine. But I have to point out that when you go to recordstoreday.com, there's a prominent link to a guide to all these events that you can download from Apple, the creator of that record store destruction device known as iTunes. Summer blockbuster season is quickly creeping toward us, and perhaps some hits for the summer are a bunch of IMAX movies. After a few years, we're all about 3D. Why is Hollywood once again gearing up to play films on that really big screen?
Here to talk with us for our Midday Extra is Matt Patches of Hollywood.com. He's with us now. Hi, Matt.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Is this a big year for IMAX? Is this going to be the year that IMAX really overtakes 3D?
Well, I think you're starting to see the trend towards IMAX. I think last year's Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, directed by Brad Bird, was a really influential movie, and especially with Chris Nolan involving IMAX into The Dark Knight, and now he has The Dark Knight Rises coming this summer, I think really people are starting to understand the potential of IMAX as an entertainment process versus 3D, and it's immersive.
It's a big undertaking shooting in IMAX. Of course, it's a big undertaking shooting in 3D. Are IMAX films even more expensive than 3D?
At the end of the day, not really. I mean, yes, you have to use these cameras, these cumbersome cameras that are huge, and the film processing. But at the end of the day, 3D shooting, if you're doing it in camera, is another huge undertaking. And the process to convert film into that stereoscopic picture is an expensive process. At the end of the day, they probably cost the same amount. And it's really about directors wanting to choose either and what makes sense for the film.
By the way, when they convert movies, as you say, from the regular old just big screen to the huge screen IMAX or to 3D IMAX or whatever, do you get the same? Is it the same quality as if they shoot it in that version?
It's really not, and I think that's why directors like Brad Bird and Christopher Nolan and J.J. Abrams, who's shooting some of the next Star Trek movie in IMAX, they want it to be that high quality, that crispness that comes with shooting in natural IMAX. You know, we just saw Wrath of the Titans in IMAX 3D, and while it has a scale to it, I mean, you're seeing it on a giant screen, but it's not that same quality that comes with shooting on a film stock that actually is a giant piece of film. You're just capturing more visual information when you shoot naturally in IMAX. So it'll always look better.
What do we know about whether or not IMAX is really helping the theaters to make money?
I definitely, Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol was the flag. Brad Bird chose to release the film prior to the actual release. He 2 weeks, I believe, beforehand, Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol came out in IMAX only, and it was a huge success. People just wanted to see it that way, and there was a big push. I mean, they released posters and trailers saying, this is an IMAX film. You have to see it in IMAX. And people did, and it was a huge moneymaker. And IMAX as a company is really pushing people. They want it to be a part of the movie-going experience. They don't want it to be a supplement. They want people to see IMAX films and for films to be created in IMAX. And it's a money-making venture for them. And I think it's really working out creatively and financially for everyone who's taking the risk.
So if we're paying $10 or $12 to see a regular movie these days, $15 or $16 to see a 3D, what's the new price now that everything's going to be in IMAX?
It'll probably be around those 3D prices. At this point, we're getting to the point where it's around $16, $18 to see a 3D movie, and I think that the ticket prices for IMAX are going to be around then. As the IMAX trend continues to grow, I think the prices will decrease as more and more IMAX theaters exist. So I don't think IMAX will ever demand more of your money than 3D or now even regular movies.
Well, we've come a long way from that first under-the-sea IMAX adventure that I saw all those years ago. That still, I remember, kind of blew my mind. It was amazing even back then. Matt Patches, Hollywood.com, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Fenway Park in Boston turns 100 years old today, and as Kurt Nickisch of WBUR in Boston reports, the park's legacy isn't all about baseball. Fenway also reversed the curse of lousy real estate.
A black and white photograph from 1909 shows the land where Fenway Park would be built.
And as you can see, it's a swamp. I mean, there's nothing there at all.
Historian Leslie Donovan says Fenway went up in 1912 on marshy land that was filled in. Construction brought in roads and electricity. The early auto industry popped up around it. What's now the Red Sox ticket office used to be a car showroom. Then came the neighborhood. Red Sox fan John Permitaris wants his grandson to see another 100 years of Fenway baseball.
This is one place you do not touch. You keep as is. This is history. This is the park of all parks.
But Fenway almost didn't make it. Team owners wanted a new stadium to sell more seats, but fans and neighbors rallied to renovate instead. After 100 years, the roots have grown deep. In Boston, I'm Kurt Nickisch for Marketplace.
And finally, David, there's a hot controversy going on between two of the coldest states in the country, Minnesota and North Dakota. Minnesota lawmakers wanted to borrow $221 million to renovate the state capitol building. And to make the case, Republican House Majority Leader Matt Dean said this, quote, "Has anyone seen North Dakota's capital? It's like State Farm Insurance called. They want their office building back. I mean, it's terrible. It's embarrassing," end quote. Well, the governor of North Dakota didn't really like that very much. He responded by saying his state capitol building is one of the most pleasing in the United States. And by the way, that little jab at North Dakota did not work out very well for Mr. Dean. The bill to borrow the money for renovations in Minnesota failed 80-50.
Yeah, and also, who has the stronger state budget? Is it going to be North Dakota or Minnesota?
That's a good point, yes.
Just look that up. I think the North Dakotans win.
In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm David Brancaccio in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.